Welcome to the Grace in Common podcast, the podcast with four friends, four theologians from four different countries and three different continents, where we talk neo-Calvinism, theology, and culture. My name is Grace Sutanto, a native of Indonesia and assistant professor here at Reformed Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. And today joining me is Marinus de Jong, pastor of the Oosterparkkerk in Amsterdam, the Netherlands, and assistant professor at the Neo-Calvinism Research Institute in Kampen, Utrecht, and James Eglinton, senior lecturer of Reformed Theology at the University of Edinburgh. All right, welcome back, everyone. We're still discussing or prompting our discussions with the chapters from our Neo-Calvinism, a Theological Introduction. And last week, we talked about the introduction to the introduction, thinking about what makes Neo-Calvinism a theological tradition and why we need it to write this theological introduction and not just a cultural or philosophical or public theological introduction. And this week, we want to start out our discussion with the second chapter, thinking about Neo-Calvinism in distinction from Calvinism. So perhaps I could first start with this question. What do we mean when we say Calvinism, and what makes Neo-Calvinism distinguished from Calvinism?
One of the ways that you introduce that in the book, Gray, that I found very helpful, and also Corey, who's not with us today, but together you introduced it by looking at a bunch of different uses of the term Calvinism, either today or in the time of the original Neo-Calvinists, where you had things like Calvinistic Baptist, for example, a bunch of different ranges of how the term was used, which is really helpful. I think when we look at the Neo-Calvinists themselves, the first generation Neo-Calvinists, it's maybe helpful to modify the terms a little bit to understand Neo-Calvinism in relation to, let's call it 16th century Calvinism, or let's just call it Paleo-Calvinism, if we're playing with Neo and Paleo for new and old. So we think of how figures like Abraham Kuyper and Herman Bavinck understood Paleo-Calvinism. There, they were talking about Reformed theology in the 16th century. They're thinking in particular about not just doctrinal developments, because there was a whole lot of theological change and realignment in the time of the Protestant Reformation, but they're also thinking a lot about the social consequences of that theological change. So if you read a speech like Kuyper's speech on Calvinism, this is it, the source and stronghold of our constitutional liberties. So it's a speech that Kuyper went around the Netherlands giving in the 1870s, where he starts to describe something that began in the 16th century through Calvin, which was the rediscovery of a really profound degree of liberty, actually, as something that should mark human life, and that comes about through the kind of rediscovery of what Christianity should be, as he thought. Calvin had rediscovered it. But the idea for the first generation of Neo-Calvinists is that something began in the 16th century in Calvin's Geneva, but it didn't end in or wasn't completed in the 16th century. So Calvinism, they think of it originally as the beginning of some kind of historical process that leads to all kinds of modern freedoms as well. So we think of the social consequences of theology, but also an ongoing process of doctrinal development, good progress in the theological life and history of the church. So I think that maybe that's a helpful way to start the conversation, to think about not Neo-Calvinism in comparison to a bunch of other different things that get called Calvinism today, or even in the early 20th century in the Netherlands, but to set up in a much bigger historical picture. So the 16th century versus the early 20th century, Paleo and Neo.
That's a really helpful way of framing it. And we're really mindful of that longer sort of look, the zoomed out look of Neo-Calvinism in distinction from the Magisterial Reformation, right, or Paleo-Calvinism there. And as we were writing it, we knew that we needed to address current historiography on 16th century, 17th century Reformation theology. So we know now that Calvinism wasn't used in a positive sense in the 16th, 17th century, right? We're not meant to isolate Calvin in distinction from all the other magisterial reformers as if he was a standard for the rest of the reformers, nor is Calvin the definitive form of the Reformed tradition, right? We have the 17th century High Orthodox tradition that developed and flowered and also went beyond Calvin in a lot of ways. And so we need to talk about, for instance, Francis Turretin, Petrus van Maastricht, Leiden Synopsis, Cuthbertus Fuytius. There's so many different figures to draw from. So when we were writing this, we were starting to realize that one of the reasons why the term Calvinism became a positive use in the first place was because of Kuyper and Bavinck. And they were trying to do this not in the way where Calvin is set against the Protestant scholastics or Protestant Reform Orthodox, but rather they did see that Calvin had a more holistic vision that was developed by the Reform Orthodox. So I think Kuyper and Bavinck were using the term even Calvinism in distinction from, say, the way Barth was using it, which really did use Calvin as a sort of standard bearer, the Calvin versus the Calvinist thesis. So Kuyper and Bavinck said Calvin was in continuity broadly with the Protestant Orthodox, not the way in which Barth was using the term Calvinism. And yet at the same time, they did see that there was something unique about Calvin. So it's almost like they're offering, I mean, forgive me for using this term, a third way between sort of the Barthian usage of Calvin versus the Calvinists, and then there's the no discontinuity at all usage of sort of recent historiography, where Calvin and the Protestant Orthodox are just one broad Catholic tradition with no real discontinuities at all between them. They see something kind of in the middle, where Calvin is doing something unique, and yet there's broad continuities between Calvin and the Protestant Orthodox. So that's a controversial thesis, as far as I can tell, with regard to contemporary historiography on the Reformation. But I think that's how they took Paleo-Calvinism. Calvin was doing something distinct, and yet not in an antagonistic sort of way over against the Protestant scholastics.
So, Gray, a question for you then in relation to that controversial claim. I've heard it argued before that it's not very helpful to talk about Calvinism in a historic sense, because that term was invented by Abraham Kuyper, and that we should, you know, talk about Calvinism in a much more recent sense historically, but not in the 16th century. But from what you've just said, it sounds like there's actually a lot in that observation that a neo-Calvinist could affirm without it necessarily undermining the connection between 16th century, whatever we'll call it, theology in the Protestant Reformation tradition, Calvinist tradition, and neo-Calvinism. Is that right?
Yes, as far as I can tell, I think so. So Calvinism was definitely a term that I don't think was invented by Kuyper, but it was used positively by Kuyper, whereas in the past it was used as a pejorative. And what Kuyper meant by it was not to, again, set aside Calvin in opposition to the Protestant Orthodox, because, again, Kuyper and Bavinck were steeped in that tradition. They were reading Fuytius, publishing editions of Junius, Fuytius, Leiden Synopsis, right? So they wanted to stand on the Reform Orthodox and wanted to say that Calvin went alongside the Reform Orthodox. And yet they did choose the term Calvinism to pick out something distinct that inspired them from the reformer at Geneva, which is, again, in broad continuity, and yet there is an impulse there that they wanted to draw from it, whether rightly or wrongly. So it's not just a mere historiographical description from Kuyper and Bavinck's perspective, this term Calvinism, but it was to denote a theological vision that they wanted to develop. And for some reason, they found more in Calvin, perhaps, as an inspiration than other things.
I think they were also using the term maybe to draw it a bit from the purely theological, right? They wanted to show this is not just something ecclesial or just theological, like maybe one could accuse Reformed Orthodoxy of, but say, no, this is something new. It was also a program, I think, to say, well, if you go to like the true Calvinism, and that's the word we're going to use now, to show that it is worldview, it is just much more than just the church. It is a vision for society and view on history and on the future and on the state and politics, etc.
Yes. So, let me direct this attention to James. And James, recently you showed a quote from Herman Bavinck on Twitter. And it's a quote that we have known for a long time, that I know Bavinck would say things like that. But it sparked a conversation, a lively conversation, of whether or not Bavinck did see some kind of discontinuity between the 16th and 17th century. And I think the answer to that is very nuanced, and you had some good responses to that. What's your understanding of how to take passages like that from Bavinck? Maybe talk about the passage first, and then how should we take passages like that?
Yeah, sure. So the perils of doing theology by tweet. So the quote is from Bevink. It's on his book. It's from his book, The Certainty of Faith, Die Sicherheit des Geloofs. And it's a quote about, it's an observation by Bevink on a shift that he identified between the 16th and the 17th centuries, where Reformed people in the 16th century confessed their beliefs. But something changed, Bevink said, amongst Reformed Christians in the 17th century, where they moved from confessing their beliefs to believing their confessions. So I shared it in the first place because it's a great turn of phrase. I really like it. I think that kind of provocative one-liner, you know, that kind of, it's almost like a witty, you know, aphorism. And to pull those off well, it's its own kind of genre, and Bevink sometimes puts them in his writing like that. And they're just worth reading because of the way that they make you think. And so anyway, that's why I shared that on Twitter, but it did get some pushback. But I think, as you say, Gray, the actual response that we have to give to try and understand how Bevink grasped the Reformed Orthodox in that period, you know, 16th, 17th century Reformed theology, does take quite a bit of nuance. It's certainly the case that Bevink was a pretty careful and committed reader of early modern Reformed Orthodox theologians. So one of the things that I found fascinating about Bevink is, or that I found fascinating in recent years, is I'm working with two PhD students at the moment, Matthew Baines, who is, I'm his secondary supervisor. He's just about to finish up with a really superb thesis on Fuchsius, and Israel Guerrero, who's just finishing up a PhD thesis on Bevink's understanding of piety. And so much of that involves Bevink trying to understand early modern Reformed Orthodox theology, actually. And the thing with Bevink and the early moderns is that there's a tremendous amount there that where he sees the Reformed Orthodox as exemplifying what we're talking about with Calvinism. Okay, we spoke about a minute ago that Calvinism in this early sense is both a form of intensely doctrinalist Christianity, and is really concerned with getting your doctrine right, and is very concerned with the church, but also that form of piety towards, let's say, a kind of church-centric piety, and a theologically generated sense of piety for Bevink, but also in the early modern figures that he drew inspiration from, like Fuchsius. That's something that pursues the Reformation, not just of doctrine or of the church, but of all of life. And so the Reformation or the expression of piety is actually a pious life looks like a life that wants to be lived for the glory of God, coram Deo, in its every square inch or in its every sphere or in every part of your life in society. So Bevink, when he reads the Reformed Orthodox, there's just a tremendous amount that he finds admirable. In terms of theology, theological formulations, he edited a new edition of the Leiden Synopsis. I think that he probably knew Fuchsius as well as almost anyone in the Netherlands in his own day. That came about actually through his 1 year as a pastor in Franeker when he was quite young, and he was editing the Leiden Synopsis. And another local pastor in the same town, a Reformed pastor, was a guy called A.C. Duker, who was the leading Fuchsius biographer of his generation. And actually, his Duker's biography of Fuchsius is a big three-part biography, is still the go-to biography of Fuchsius. And they became acquaintances and friends really early on in Bevink's life. And theologically, they were quite different, but they kept up that that contact. And through him, Bevink became really closely, you know, he had like a front row seat in a really close sense to the best Fuchsius scholarship of the day, as well as having read him really extensively. But what he gets from Fuchsius isn't just doctrinal reformation, but actually Fuchsius, I mean, I don't want to sound anachronistic and project back because that would be really bad historical scholarship. But when you really get to know Fuchsius, and I've tried to do this a bit more through working with Matt Baines in his Fuchsius PhD, Fuchsius really sounds and feels a lot like an early modern neo-Calvinist. Or the more historically accurate way to put that might be that Bevink, when you actually get to know Fuchsius theologically and socially, Bevink is actually very much like a late 19th, early 20th century Fuchsian. So there's some kind of continuity of between Neo-Calvinism and the Reformed Orthodox that's really important. So Bavinck looks back and he'll find a lot of things that are really praiseworthy theologically, tremendously, and that he draws huge inspiration from, as did Kuyper as well with Fuchsius and the Reformed Orthodox. But the thing is, when Bavinck reads those figures, he recognizes that they were doing something the process of Reformation in their day, in their context. And what Fuchsius did was tremendously new in all kinds of ways. And the thing is, the way to receive Reformed Orthodoxy isn't just to hit pause on the process of history and try and live in the 16th century or the 17th century when you're in the early 21st or the early 20th century in Amsterdam. Instead, you receive the tradition by continuing it. And then traditions to continue like that need an element of self-critique. So you'll find Bavinck being critical in some parts of Reformed Orthodoxy, really appreciative of others. But you'll find him, I mean, Gray, you translated this in the introduction to The Wonderful Works of God. And this wasn't translated in the earlier editions of that book, but we now have this thanks to your work there, where Bavinck talks, you know, about texts that he himself really appreciates, Wilhelmus of Brachel and so on, that you can't just give those texts to someone today and think that this asks all of the questions that people ask nowadays, because we're no longer 16th century or 17th century people. So the tradition has to be a living one, and that means it has to keep on going on and keep on developing.
That's a fascinating description, James. Thanks so much for giving so much granularity to that. And isn't it also the case that, you know, to even understand Reformed theology as both a looking back and looking forward is a distinctive of Neo-Calvinism, right? So one of the things that gets thrown out in this sort of discussion or thrown up in this discussion is the term semper reformanda, this idea of reformed but always reforming. And so when we take a look at Bavinck's description of Calvinism, say in the future of Calvinism, he talks about how Reformed theology is just an ecclesial reality, like what Marinus was saying, but Calvinism was a whole full orb sort of theological system of the world. He calls it a whole physiognomy, right? And then later on in the mature Bavinck, we do see him, for instance, in Modernism and Orthodoxy, that particular piece in 1911. He said that to be reformed means to be reformed back to the earliest creeds and confessions of the church, but at the same time to keep reforming for the future. And there's lots of historians, I think, who would say and push back against that sort of definition and said that idea of keeping reforming, this idea of semper reformanda in the 16th and 17th century. I remember even in seminary, in church history classes, I would be taught that term in the 16th, 17th century really referred to the reformation of your life, that you have to keep reforming your life in accordance with the word of God, but not necessarily your theological confession or your doctrine. Because that whatever is true for all time. Whatever is true continues to be true even today, if that makes sense. So it's not calling for a kind of reformation of doctrine, but rather a reformation of life. Now, I'm simplifying, of course, but it seems to me that Bavinck, perhaps, if that sort of historiography is true, and I think there's something to it, is really offering a modification, perhaps, or an adjustment or an advancement of something within the Reformed tradition that perhaps wasn't really emphasized in the 16th, 17th century, that Reformation refers to not only life, but also doctrine. And hence, there's this sensibility of historical consciousness and also a sensibility of contextualization and conditionness, contingency of the human reception of theology that perhaps isn't as amplified in the early modern context. And that shows Neo-Calvinistic sort of modern and postmodern reception or tendencies, perhaps. So, I mean, Clam Clausing's dissertation, I'm sure, would play a role into this sort of definition and discussion as well. But I wonder what you all would think about that.
It makes me think of how Neo-Calvinism was received in the beginning, and also there the debate that kind of still is there. What's the relation between Calvinism and this new Calvinist movement? That there was also this like dual relationship. So in your chapter, Gray and also Corey, you talk about how people like kind of took Kuyper and also Bavinck as kind of antiquated in many ways, right? They were like, oh, this is like taking all the old doctrines that we have become critical of. That's Holten and Kühnen in Leiden were treated in a critical fashion and maybe thought we should leave them behind, that they just put them center stage. At the same time, and this is something you talk about a little bit less in your book, there were also responses who took neo-Calvinism as not antiquated, but quite the opposite. There's, for example, a guy called Erdmans, who may or not be related to the publisher, I have no idea, but he was a very modern modern theologian, and he said, well, this is just another way of secularization. All this talk about worldview, it externalizes the faith and just makes it into something secular and makes God obsolete. And someone else said, well, no, the big difference between neo-Calvinism and Calvinism is that neo-Calvinism is naturalist and Calvinism is supernaturalist. This is something by Hilcomb, I think, somewhere in the 1910s, he says this towards this then new movement. So what is so fascinating, and maybe is kind of a compliment, that if some people say you're way too modern and you're externalizing faith, and others say, no, you're antiquated and it's just outdated what you're doing, then you indeed have kind of what you just described, Gray, a kind of third and middle way, saying, no, we need to be looking backwards toward the past, and we also need to be looking forward and contextualize what tradition has given us and what we read in the scriptures and what the gospel is into today's context. Hence also dare change things and make new and fresh applications.
Yeah, so I recognize some of that, although in a kind of popular church culture, when I think of Reformed evangelical church culture, at least in Scotland, I suspect probably in the wider UK as well, over the last few decades. So rather than the Erdmans-Baving debate is obviously very high level, theologians publishing books against each other 100 years ago. But in church culture, I think you see the same kind of traits and paradigm, where I can think of big segments of the Reformed population in the UK who probably do look back more than forward. It's really important that you read the Puritans and read early modern Reformed literature and so on. But a lot of those contexts are maybe a bit disconnected from thinking about the current day or missiology or something like that. There are other segments of the Reformed population where, you'll turn up at a church planting conference and everything will be very kind of activist and engaged, but they're often not the same people who are trying to look back as well as forward. And I think this was actually something that I found tremendously heartening when I discovered, well, Bavinck in the first place, and then neo-Calvinism was a tradition that's intentionally, trying to look both ways. It's almost like you learn how to be a chameleon, and not in the sense of changing your color, but have you ever watched a chameleon's eyes? They're quite incredible. It's completely bi-directional all the time, and it can focus on two things at once. I wanted to be like that in thinking historically and about the present and the future as well within the Reformed tradition. So that's something that I really loved about neo-Calvinism from the start.
Yeah, so I think we are really picking up on something that's the contribution, or one of the contributions of neo-Calvinism as opposed to paleo-Calvinism, is this historical consciousness and the conditionedness of doing theology, which I think is fitting given who we are as made in God's image. We're finite, we know ectopically, and so on. And I think we could have probably brought that more explicitly in the book. I do think in the next chapter, Catholic and Modern, we bring this sense of looking back and looking forward as a distinctive, but we haven't really talked about how distinctive it is vis-a-vis earlier traditions of Reformed theology, which perhaps has less of that notion of historical conditionedness and the way in which we receive theology in our own geographically and temporally limited ways, which contextualizes the way in which we receive God's revelation, which I think, again, is a contribution of neo-Calvinism. So wondering now too then, James, if that is a feature of neo-Calvinism, in what way, therefore, was Fuchius doing this neo-Calvinistic, or rather, Bavinck was being a Fuchsian in the 19th century? I think I know perhaps what you might say, but I'd be curious to see what you're seeing in Fuchius, especially because I think, Fuchius's response to, for instance, the debate between geocentricism and heliocentricism was quite a debated thing, let's just say, in the contemporary receptions of Fuchius. So there's lots of authors, for instance, I was reading Gijsbert van den Brink's Reformed Theology and Evolutionary Theory, again recently, and he was very critical of Fuchs in this respect because he tried to tether reform theology with geocentricism in his own day. So I wonder what you're seeing exactly.
Yeah, so I think within Fuchs you see... So I can show you something about that historical consciousness, actually, or something that looks like that in his own immediate context. So one of the texts by Fuchs that is most well received, or that was most well received and of interest to the first generation neo-Calvinists, was his catechism on the Heidelberg Catechism. Okay, so this is Abraham Kuyper reissued it in the late 19th century. Forget the year exactly. It's a massive, massive work, and it looks quite confusing to read at the beginning because in the first place it is a catechism of a catechism. So it's a teaching tool on a teaching tool, and it's like four books layered on top of each other on every page. And what I mean by that is that, so it's written like a catechism. It is a catechism. So question, answer, question, answer. And every question is ranked either A, B, C, or D. And those are an ascending level of conceptual complexity. So the A questions are pretty simple. You know, how do I know Jesus loves me? Because the Bible tells me so. Very complex answer, but also, you know, you can teach that to a small child. Whereas a level D question would be, can I know what a soul is made of? Something like that, that gets very metaphysical. Okay, and then B and C are somewhere in between. But the idea is that it's four books in one so that you could teach it to a small child or to a university student. Anyway, that's a brief introduction to it. And Abraham Kuyper reissued it and thought that it was great. And actually, Matt Baines and I have been slowly translating it together over a number of years. It's a massive, massive work. But, you know, if you produce... in the early modern period, a catechism on an early modern catechism, I think that itself is a window into a similar kind of historical consciousness, because you understand when the catechism is still not that old, you understand already that the application of that catechism is going to be contingent on historical context. And so many of the questions in his catechism on the catechism are 16th century questions. So there are questions like, at least in a Western European context, questions like, my grandparents were Roman Catholic and I've become Reformed, or my parents were Roman Catholic and I've become Reformed. Can I expect to see them in heaven? So it's a pastoral question, but it's a relevant contextual question. Some of the questions contextually are really fascinating. Like if you hear of someone who is from a Muslim context who says they've had a dream about Jesus and they now believe in him, but they've never actually read the Christian scriptures, can we know for sure whether that person has truly been converted? In Fuchs's own context, that's a question that comes about actually through trying to understand trade routes, some kind of context between the Muslim world and the Netherlands in the early modern period. So the questions are really intensely contextual, and they're all an elaboration of, you know, the Heidelberg Catechism is not that long, but he writes a colossal commentary or catechism on it as a contextual application of it. So if you read a catechism of a catechism, you have a quite well-attuned historical consciousness to do with the reception of doctrine, and you will accept that in future generations, they will have different questions, and their catechism on the catechism will be different. So in that regard, the historical consciousness, I think, is there's continuity there. But Fuchs was also just a breathtakingly creative person, actually, in lots of areas of life. So Anna Maria von Schürmann, the first woman theology student, I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, it's the first woman to sit in university classes in the Netherlands, I think. I mean, it was controversial at the time, and she ended up kind of falling out with Fuchs over something else. But she wanted to take his classes, so she had to like sit in a kind of side room behind a screen while the class was going on, so that the male students wouldn't be shocked by having a woman there. But he's really innovative, we could call him, in that kind of a context in his early modern period. Fuchs wrote a book called, in Latin, the Planting of Churches, and just did tons of really creative stuff where he was like working with, again, in his own time, quite innovative. Church planting meant sending people to unreached parts of the world. So he would negotiate with with merchant ship owners to have missionaries sent it's like on these boats as they went to different parts of the world. And all of that is in its own way very novel and very creative. So he's really thinking outside the box on lots of things. But I think part of the real continuity as well as the historical consciousness is something that Israel's dissertation shows really pretty compellingly, which is that this is all rooted in a very distinct kind of reformed piety. The idea that to become a pious Christian isn't just you know, reducible to moments of direct encounter with the means of grace, you know, just when you're at church or just at the Lord's table or just when you are when you're reading the Bible on your own at home, and then that's this sealed off space in your existence and that's where piety happens. But for Fuchsius, piety extends out into the rest of life, actually, and it creates, I think, an intentionality about the desire to be actively Christian in each part of your life. At least that's how Bavinck sees him and wants to be like him as well. So and that's all, it's very modern in its own way, I think, for Fuchsius as well as for Bavinck, and having quite a modern view of institutions, that you can go out there and change the world, and that it can be remade or reformed, and so that you would want to do so in a way that brings it, you know, coram Deo. So I think there's Bavinck is a kind of like late modern follower of Fuchsius in lots of ways.
That's really helpful. Marinus, I mean, right before we're getting to record here, we were just talking about how there's a reoccurring critique of neo-Calvinism as being a very anti-theological, again, cultural, naturalist sort of endeavor. I wonder, you know, especially given our discussion now, it seems to me that that sort of critique just cannot stand. I mean, obviously, one of the things that I say to my students is, if you want to write or think like Bavinck, you can't just be reading Bavinck. You got to read what he read. So we try to assign as much as possible to Reform Scholastics, as much as, you know, students can. I mean, because this is not immediately accessible material, but I try to assign as much as we can, Tyrton, Leiden Synopsis, and so on. So to say that Neo-Calvinism is somehow in contrast to the older tradition, I think is a myth. But I see that also happening in various, perhaps, Dutch receptions of Neo-Calvinism. They would say, you know, because we follow Bavinck, we have to move on. Or even some American receptions, because we follow Neo-Calvinism, we have to eschew all older sort of Greek Hellenized traditions of Reformed theology or something like that. So I just wonder, in your own context, in what ways have Neo-Calvinism been used to actually not just look forward, but they eschew the other paths, the other aspect, which is looking back. So we talk about Neo-Calvinism being looking back and looking forward, but they just pick up the looking forward part. We've critiqued those people who say we just got to look backwards. But now what about those who say we got to look forward? And that, I think, is the aspect that creates this impression that Neo-Calvinism is just a naturalist perspective.
Yeah. Well, I think the view of like the forward-looking Neo-Calvinism is also is what like haunting the imagination in the Dutch context as well as in the United States. And it was the case, I think, in the beginning of the 20th century. But in the second half of the, I mean, it's almost the people say, well, the secularization of Protestantism here was kind of, as if it was, as if the engine of that was Neo-Calvinism. That's like almost seems to be what people think. And for example, the theologian Hardy Kuytert, who is, I think, not very well known outside of the Netherlands. He was a Free University dogmatician, and he famously, and he kind of worked in the line. He was a Neo-Calvinist. He worked in the line of Abraham Kuyper, and he famously like abandoned the faith altogether, and always claimed to be a Neo-Calvinist lineage, just like saying B where Kuyper had said A. What people often overlook, I think, there, and maybe subconsciously that's why you addressed the question to me, is I think that Schilder is an example of someone who does exactly the opposite. And people tend to see only Kuytert as the heir to Kuyper, but Schilder is just as much an heir to Kuyper. And of course, he criticizes Kuyper. We've discussed it many times in this podcast, but there's also many quotes of Schilder saying, well, you say I'm criticizing Kuyper, but pardon me, I'm just going back to Bavinck. So Schilder at least saw himself also in the line of Kuiper and Bafing, but he, I think, in his own context, wanted to emphasize the backward-looking part of neo-Calvinism. And see, doing that within the line of Calvinism and his neo-Calvinist forebears. And I think that is also explains why, for Schilder, Reformed Orthodoxy becomes, again, a very important conversation partner. If you take a look at his Heidelberg Catechism commentary, which was to become his main dogmatic work, he seems to be only almost uniquely in discussion with Reformed Orthodoxy. And why is that? That is because he sensed that it was necessary for his new Calvinist tradition to strike the right balance between looking forward and looking backward. And that's why he thought, well, let's start looking back and indeed start reading again what Bavik and Kuiper themselves were reading and where it all came from. That is also why his dogmatic work was not a Reformed Dogmatics, but was a commentary on Heidelberg Catechism. There was like a back to the Confessions. But for him, that did not mean at all that he was like abandoning the worldview or the holistic approach to theology. Of course, he made some correctives at some point in saying that maybe this can lead, and we've talked about common grace, which has always been attacked by many people, also from the beginning, from the side of Barthians, but also by Schilder himself, saying maybe common grace has a secularizing tendency. Maybe it can be used in a way that we're going forward too soon and too quickly. So yes, he criticized, but I think and this is something I've argued also many times, is that what Schilder's view was to keep the forward direction, like the opening up of life, of entire life, quodam Deo, and never like locking up Christianity inside the church. That's really the main thrust also of his theological work, exactly in line with Bavik and Kuiper. So yeah, I think he is an important example in that respect. And also the church that he kind of left, I mean, we talked about that as well. He was part of a schism in the church, which was very painful, but it also resulted in in many ways strong and committed church that had withstood secularization in a way that many other churches didn't. And this, of course, you cannot say this is uniquely related to Schilder, but it definitely are links between that and the way Schilder developed neo-Calvinism.
So I wonder if I could say something that maybe is controversial to some ears, but I wonder what you all think about this. You know, one of the things that we said, at the very end of the book, we offer 16 theses. The first thesis is that neo-Calvinism is a critical reception of Reform Orthodoxy. So to the extent that you're not wrestling with the Reformed scholastics and the Orthodox and Calvin and the magisterial reformers and receiving it in some way and embracing it, I would argue, in some way. So confessionalism is to the extent that you're not really neo-Calvinistic. So confessionalism, Reformed theology, holding on to that past rather than eschewing it, is a necessary feature of neo-Calvinism. And I don't think that's controversial among us, I would say, but perhaps to some who would just look forward, that would be controversial, because I have read some who claim to be neo-Calvinists and they say, well, because we're neo-Calvinistic, we got to move on, just move on and depart from the past.
Yeah, well,
yeah, it's yeah, not controversial to me.
No, it's the same to me. I mean, it's indeed what you say. I mean, it seems kind of obvious to me even. I mean, also Kuiper himself, I mean, he was the one who made...
That's good.
Who like made the three, what we now call the three forms of unity, which is like the Belgian Confession, Heidelberg Catechism, and the Canons of Dort, who made them into this like a trinity almost as the hallmark of what it means to be reformed in our context. That is something that came from Kuiper. So to like loosen the confessions and Reformed Orthodoxy from them seems to me impossible. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that something I find very helpful about your first chapter in the book is the way that it elucidates the difference between the value of conserving what is good and something like a deadening conservatism, where things are being conserved uncritically. So it's good because it's old. And I think what you see in at least the early neo-Calvinists, and I guess what we're trying to preserve, and then what you encapsulate in that first thesis, is that neo-Calvinism should offer something different to just it's old, therefore it's good, and therefore we're stuck with it, and we wouldn't want to change it in any way ever, and it's just kept as it has always been. Or the opposite, it's bad because it's old, and we are always progressing and moving forward. And neo-Calvinism has a different kind of instinct in terms of the value of conserving and its own distinct sense of what it means to be conservative as well. And maybe a good example of what this looks like in neo-Calvinism as well is it's from a speech that Kuyper gave to the students at the Free University, I think fairly early on in the history of the institution, where his goal was for the Free University was that it would be three things. And I think these are so illustrative together on what he wanted for neo-Calvinism. So the first goal of the Free University was that it would be a conservatorium, a place that does actually retain, it's a repository of things that are good and true and beautiful. From that basis, it becomes an observatory, in that you actually have a vantage point from which to look out into the world, to observe things there, and to test whether they are good and true and beautiful. And thirdly, the Free University should be a laboratory, because you have both things that you have conserved, and you make observations about the world. You're therefore able to experiment and to think, but with particular tools and resources and from a particular vantage point. And then the university becomes a constructive place to think about how do you improve the world? How do you make progress in knowledge and change the world for the better? And I think that those three things together, actually, I mean, that all just grows out of the same way of thinking as the first thesis that you guys give in the book as well, that you have to have a particular way of conserving in order to be able to observe, in order to experiment.
I think it's important to say that, and to say it over and over again, perhaps, and perhaps we haven't been emphasizing it enough, because there's still a reoccurring worry, perhaps, when people hear neo-Calvinism, they immediately say, well, it's just a very modern thing, and, you know, it's we really just want to go back to Reform Orthodoxy. And my main instinct with that is just to say, well, neo-Calvinism is a way of inhabiting Reform Orthodoxy. It's not representation, but it definitely wants to receive it. And to the extent, therefore, and the reason why I think what I was trying to say and what we take as non-controversial here might be controversial in some circles, because there are some self-ascribed neo-Calvinists who want a more revolutionary perspective, where they just want to start something new from scratch. And I don't think that's possible, and I wonder to what extent that could be described as neo-Calvinistic. So I think that's what I'm trying to make explicit, perhaps, in this conversation.
And also, it's just good to acknowledge that it's a difficult balance to be in. It's just kind of easier to say, well, we're just going to repristinate and we want to go back and we're going to withdraw kind of into an imagined past. And on the other hand, saying, no, we need to just move forward, go with the flow. These are both just easier options. And there's always kind of the temptation to go in either of those ways. I mean, I feel it myself being a pastor in Amsterdam. I mean, I live in an extremely progressive city where this narrative of we are moving forward and we are the avant-garde of the world, which they aren't, but they think they are, is in everybody's imagination. Also, the people who are also in myself and the people who are sitting in my pews. So it's that just makes it pretty challenging to do that, to not like to be indeed. To adopt kind of the progressive narrative, because Christianity is progressive, but not fall into the trap of like going into with progressivism and I remember when I was a student, I was like, I'm in a church, and I felt the church needed to move forward more than it did, like the church I grew up in, and I thought it needed change. And when I became a pastor in Amsterdam after a year, maybe I thought, oh no, this I need to do something else here. what is much more important now, and this also shows how contextual I think it is, what is much more important is the conservation part, is to make sure we do not forget to look back and do not like completely adopt the progressivist narrative that is so abundant in the city we live in and in the country as in general.
Yeah, I really like that. I think so in the early context of neo-Calvinism, there's a heavy application of the difference between conserving well and being bound by deadly conservatism, because Christianity has its own account of how to conserve things that are good, true, and beautiful. And that can develop really wrongly when it becomes a kind of conservatism, Bavinck and Kuyper thought. But for neo-Calvinism, 100 years on, things seem to have flipped a bit, where there's a deadly progressivism, and Christianity has to think about progress on its own terms as well. And neo-Calvinism gives some really good resources for that. Something I'm conscious of in our conversation so far is that we've been speaking in a pretty Western context, in the context of Western European history, thinking about paleo-Calvinism in Geneva in the 16th century, and then neo-Calvinism 100 years on. But I'm curious about your thoughts on neo-Calvinism in a non-Western context as an extension of this conversation. So someone who's listening to this might think, okay, in order for neo-Calvinism to develop, your own history first needs to have had paleo-Calvinism, and you know, no Geneva, no Amsterdam a few hundred years later. Can neo-Calvinism be... can it be exported to non-Western contexts that didn't have paleo-Calvinism first? What does that mean, or what does it look like? Is it an imperialistic choice either to decide, no, it shall not be exported and these people shall not receive our neo-Calvinism, or is it imperialistic to export it, or is neither? Is this a completely wrong question?
Yeah, well, I would suggest that neo-Calvinism is a precondition for maintaining the contextualized character of all theology and yet the enduring truth of all theology, if that makes sense. I think here again, we fall into two false directions, a false binary, where on the one hand, because of fear of imperialism and colonialization, we fear that if we communicate the gospel to an alien culture, we're really just eradicating that culture. And we are really imposing some kind of alien system, right? Especially a Western system, we wouldn't want that. So there's an argument to be made in that sort of circle. They would say, well, all missions is inherently colonialistic, right? And then on the other hand, there's this idea that we should communicate the gospel and we should eradicate the culture, right? Because the gospel is so tethered to Western culture, and that's also false. So I think neo-Calvinism gives us a perspective where we can communicate some enduring truths, and yet the culture that it finds those truths in will in some way shape the way in which those truths are being communicated. And at the same time, that truth will leaven the culture in which it finds itself in a distinct way. So I think with regard to, for instance, Paul's letters, he's very sensitive to this. Already we see in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, where he talks about the Jews demanding signs and the Greeks demanding wisdom, and yet Christ is the true wisdom and the true power. Right, so he takes the ideals of these two different cultures and tries to present the gospel in ways that uses those ideals and the idiom of those cultures to communicate the same gospel. He doesn't just go back to death and resurrection and forgiveness and uses just those three terms, but he tries to see, what did the Greeks want? Well, they want wisdom. What did the Jews want? Well, they want signs. Well, how do I show them that the gospel actually fulfills these ideals in a way that subverts their expectations, right? So we talked about subversive fulfillment. So I think, for instance, in an Asian context, we got to talk about Christ being the true giver of honor, that even though your family heritage might dishonor you or might see you as being unloyal to your familial inheritance and identity, well, here is an inheritance and an identity, an honor from an eternal father that you know, no one could take away, for instance. So I think it gives you a precondition to be both contextualized and have this idea of an enduring truth. One thing I will say, retrospectively, given that this was an episode that we had in a previous season, when Keller talked about Harvey Kahn saying that we need a new confession in Korea because the Westminster Confession of Faith has perhaps language about parental authority that could be taken in the wrong way in a Confucianist context like Korea, I would nuance that a bit more now and say not that we need a completely new confession, but we need perhaps a confession that learns from the Westminster standards and continues to uphold what's good and true there, and yet communicates the material on, let's say, authority in a distinct way in the Korean context. So I would want to see a kind of unity and diversity motif in our writing of confessions in the different contexts in which we find ourselves in, rather than merely representing one particular confession, which would be uniformity. So Bovink argues in Future of Calvinism, Protestantism has always recognized the individuality of the nations. So we have the French Confession, the Scott Confession, the Genevan Catechism, the Lutheran Catechism, Westminster Standards, three forms of unity. And yet there's a unity of theology with different questions being addressed and different accents being addressed in each of these confessional statements. And I think we have to globalize that sort of perspective as well. So that's my brief answer. I wonder what you would think about that with Johann Bavinck, for instance. He also gives some good insights on this.
So J.H. Bavinck's insight is really interesting, and it is to distinguish the fruit of... So the root and the fruit of the Christianization of Western culture. So the distinction here is all centered on the life and the conversion of Augustine of Hippo. J.H. Bavinck sees Augustine as the architect of Western culture, Christianized Western culture. And for J.H. Bavinck, it's Augustine's world, and Western people are all just living in it. And nothing is explicable without Augustine, because Augustine overcomes a kind of pagan cosmological way to be human, to exist within the world. And he swaps that kind of pagan cosmology for a theological view of the world. So a world that is conceived of in relation to a divine creator, redeemer who exists independently of it. And in order to get to that, so this is kind of a fancy way of talking about what it meant for Augustine to become a Christian. So before this, he'd been a Manichae, he'd been a Neoplatonist for a while. And before that, he'd lived for pleasure. He'd lived more sensually, in a more immediate way within the world. But the world that Augustine has to overturn, both personally, existentially, intellectually, to become a Christian, is a pre-Western world for J.H. Bavinck. So the pre-Western world, pre-Christianized world that Augustine knew before his conversion, J.H. thought is paradigmatically, it offers the same limited set of options about major questions as the non-Western pre-Christianized worlds in J.H. Bavinck's day in the mid-20th century. So rather than take, conversion stories of people who become Christians within that Western world, hundreds and hundreds of years after Augustine, you just take the story of Augustine. So he lived on Java. He spent a lot of time communicating the story of Augustine's confessions to local people in local languages. And the idea was that Augustine's story should be much more relatable to people there as non-Western folk than Augustine's story if you were just to read it in Amsterdam in the Netherlands with people there, because they've been so deeply Christianized for so long that that Augustine's life before is just a very distant, far removed thing. Whereas if you're Javanese in that period, if you're like an animist, if you spend your life in a very cosmological rather than theological framework, and you read the early chapters of Augustine's Confessions, then the world that he's trying to overturn is also your world. As well as that, he's African, so he's not European, he's not Western in that sense. But his conversion creates the West. So Augustine and his conversion is the root of Western culture or Christianization. But the fruit that grows from that is particular to the West. So J.H. Bavinck's idea is that instead of taking the fruits of Augustine's conversion, so export Western culture, you export Augustine himself and his story, and then you plant that and then see what will grow. So I wrote an article about this last year in the Journal of Biblical and Theological Studies called Planting Tulips in the Rainforest, which was a comparison of Herman Bavinck on Calvinism as an export product to non-Western cultures and J.H. Bavinck with that approach. But what I'm still trying to get to in J.H. Bavinck, I'm still trying to grapple with and understand, is how that kind of indigenous growth of Christianity in the non-Western world nonetheless retains some kind of contemporary Catholicity. So it's not deprived of knowing everything that has developed in other parts of the world, as though it has to be shielded from that, as though these Christians there should have no right to know what has happened in the history of Christianity, and they should have no common sense of fraternity and being able to access that and glean insights, and if they want to identify in some kind of shared way with Christian traditions in the West. So but this is part of the long-term reading project in J.H. Bavinck to try and get to grips with that.
Yeah, I kind of can imagine that it's in some ways an artificial distinction that doesn't like work all the way down, right? Because you severing the root from the fruit is it cannot be like completely disconnected from the two. There is indeed, as you say, like you cannot just drop Augustine in a kind of like a pure way in a different culture without everything that's attached to it. And in any way, I mean, the today's culture you always bring whenever you come, and how you say, and it's also present. I mean, we live in a globalized country, so all the different nations and cultures like influence each other enormously. I think also much more, much quicker than it used to be. So yeah, I can see there is it's just kind of organic, I guess, the way it works, and that also is the way in which like neo-Calvinism is exported, if you want to say. I mean, it just people with a different, I mean, I probably read it differently than you do. And then other people also read and like engage and apply it in their own ways, and which makes it becomes like different fruits will be carried in different places, but at the same time, it retains some kind of Catholicity.
But yeah, and this podcast is some kind of evidence of that. Four friends, four neo-Calvinists from four countries on three continents, and where the reception of the tradition is quite distinct in each. So this has been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed taking part in it. I hope that you as listeners have enjoyed listening along with our conversation. As always, please click subscribe with whatever podcast app you use for future episodes. And also please review the podcast. All of those analytics help other people find out about it. So if you have enjoyed it and would like to share it with others, please do so. Until next time, this is Grace in Common.